Well, before I begin this morning, I want to express publicly a great welcome to Jay and Sue Gunstein's honored service. You there, and yeah, glad you could be here this morning. Now, one of the highlights for me when I was a young lad growing up was building sandcastles and other great monuments on the ocean beach. See, every other year, as a family, we would go on vacation to the sun and the erosive force of the incoming tide. We kept the sand of our masterpieces damp so that it would stick together, and we dug these deep trenches around the structures and made an intricate system of channels and tunnels to divert the water when it came in. We incorporated driftwood and pebbles and even seaweed that would provide substance against the forces of nature. And it worked. Believe it or not, it worked for a while until the inevitable end came and nothing was left. Sandcastles washed away. These mighty fortresses no longer exist. You can go there yourself and look, and you won't find them anymore. Tragic, isn't it? Last Sunday, we began a new series from the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, which I'm calling Living with the End in View. The opening verse describes the book as the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, which, along with other things said by and about the preacher in the book, identifies him with Solomon, who succeeded the great king David to the throne. Solomon, known as the wisest man in the ancient world, the richest, and one of the great kings, perhaps in some ways even David and greater than David, renowned for his wealth, renowned for his wisdom, renowned for his trade and prosperity of his people. The closing verses further describe the preacher as a wise man who taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. Says that he sought to find words of delight and uprightly wrote words of truth. It's the book we now have in our hands, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. A book that teaches us to live, as I mentioned last week, with one foot in the grave. Throughout Ecclesiastes, the preacher relentlessly has the end in view. Our end, your end, my end, in this life. And the accounting we must give to our Creator of how we lived it. And the bottom line conclusion to be drawn of how we're to live, what's left of it. Some of us may have a lot left. Some of us may not have too much left. None of us knows for sure how long, or even close for sure. Are you among those who live as though this life is all there is? Are you among those whose greatest treasures are here and now? Do your lifestyle desires, the home you want to live in, the money you spend, and the things you live for, do these reveal an underlying attitude that this life is permanent? Is that how you're thinking and living, as if it is? How tight is your hold on the good things of this world, and how freely do you lavish your affections on them? If you struggle with these things, this book is for you. And all the rest of us who struggle with those things as well. And there's probably hardly a person around who doesn't struggle with any of those things to some degree, because the pull of this world is so tight on us. Last Sunday, in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verses 1 through 11, the preacher confronted us with the reality that our time in this life and whatever gain that we get from it by our hard work will soon end. The pattern of the world itself, the preacher showed us, leads to this. It points to this. In his explorations of life as it is, which follow in the rest of the book, his conclusions develop the theme for us and point us beyond ourselves. The theme that this life is temporary, our time is short, and the things we accomplish, the things we gain, well, as Ron Blue says, you never see a hearse taking a U-Haul. Sometimes the preacher does this and develops this theme in surprising and unexpected ways. His explorations of this life in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verses 12 through chapter 2 and verse 26 bring us face to face with the reality that this world offers nothing which can ultimately satisfy us. But when we accept this limitation, when we see life for what it really is, you see, he's a realist here on this, and he's trying to help us to be realist with regard to this life. When we accept this limitation and we receive the life as God's gift, this life as God's gift, we will find deep joy in it. But we can't make of this life what it was never intended to be or what it was ever intended to give. First, in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 12 to 18, the preacher gives us a preview to the conclusions of his explorations. He'll go through several explorations this morning. He explains how in searching out everything in this life by wisdom, in the end, he was left staring at the cold, hard fact of life's brutal emptiness. In a word, he was mugged by reality. Searching out this life by wisdom is chasing the wind. That's what he says. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verses 12 through 14 to begin with. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. Now here the preacher speaks as an ancient Near Eastern king would and giving a royal testament to his people. That's the picture here. He's bequeathing his wisdom to his people. He cares about them and he wants to instruct them. He leaves his wisdom with them. But ironically, his wisdom, as it's been expressed here, only leads to the inability to grasp life, and it increases pain. In verse 13, he's conducted his intense and comprehensive investigation into the meaning of life by wisdom. That is, by his carefully considered observation, his reason, and his experience. The late physicist Stephen Hawking might have called it the search for the theory of everything. But through the quest, though the quest has been given by God for us humans to be occupied with, what's the meaning of life? The preacher found it to be an unhappy business. He concludes in verse 14 that in this life, all is vanity, or all is a vapor, all is transitory, all is like a mist, a mere breath, and a striving after the wind. More literally, all is vapor and shepherding the wind. The word striving there, or chasing after, actually is used very often for the shepherd's caring and shepherding of his sheep or his goats. Here, the image that's suggested is of a shepherd trying to herd or shepherd the wind as he would sheep and goats. He repeats his conclusion of striving after the wind in verse 17 and again three more times in chapter 2. Why? Why does he use that imagery there? Why does he have that picture of trying to shepherd the wind, an impossible thing? Well, the preacher gives us two reasons for this, both expressed in Proverbs. First, searching out this life by wisdom is trying to shepherd or chase the wind because you cannot make the world different from how it actually is. Not in its great patterns of life, not in its existence. Yeah, there are minor changes, but as we saw last week, whatever we do is repetitive of what humans have done for centuries and centuries and centuries. The proverb in verse 15 explains the reason here. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. The point is that the world is both broken and incomplete. It's a fallen world. You cannot change the world as it's given. Now contrast this with Ecclesiastes 7:13 with regard to God. Consider the work of God. Consider creation. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Try. You cannot do it. If you try, you'll be frustrated. You'll be at a loss. Second, searching out this life by wisdom is trying to shepherd or chase the wind Because the more you learn of life, the more you gain wisdom, so-called wisdom, the more your sorrow is. Verses 16 to 18. I said in my heart, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceived that this also is a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, don't you find that true? The more that we understand the world, the more that we know about what's going on, what do you hear about all the time when you listen to the news? Wars, people getting murdered, people experiencing all kinds of harm and hurt and sorrow, things not working, the wrong politicians getting in, the right politicians getting in, and you find out they weren't what they thought they were. Who knows? All kinds of things and all kinds of areas of life. The more we try to figure it out, the more frustrating it gets. The more we're disappointed, the more sorrow comes with the more you know. It was great when we didn't have all this great technology and we didn't know what was happening in the rest of the world, right? Ignorance is bliss, right? No. One of the commentators talks about having the experience of being at one of the parties in the college that he was at, and one of the top students in the era of philosophy spent his time banging his head against the wall as he was drinking vodka. He was so broken by what he was learning, what he was thinking through, and his awareness of the world. This one avenue wisdom can take us down. The more you learn of life, the more your sorrow. The preacher excelled at gaining wisdom more than anyone else in his time or before. But when he applied himself to understand the deeper essence of the differences between sanity and wisdom and their opposites, madness and foolishness, it was all elusive, all was empty. Someone has said it's a fine line between genius and insanity. I don't know how true that is, but there are so many things in this life that you can cross one way or the other in. You try to figure it out. Why do certain people that you would never guess do tragic, violent things? You know, a lot of times there are warning signals on it, but sometimes we found in recently that there aren't. Why? 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 How do you distinguish between genius and madness or wisdom and foolishness? You can't always tell. So searching out this life by wisdom, one which focuses on what you see and what you observe, how you reason, how you try to put it together, is chasing the wind. That is also the outcome of the preacher's test of pleasure and the good life in verses 1 through 11 of chapter 2. Seeking gain from pleasures is chasing the wind. We're going to have some repetition here about chasing the wind. Verses 1 and 2 of chapter 2. I said in my heart, notice a lot of this is going on in his heart, his thinking, his meditation on things, his reasoning. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Who's he talking to? He's talking to himself. Who was it? Someone last night says at the missions meeting we're at, they were talking. Yeah, I forget who it was now. Was it Adrian? Yeah, it was Adrian. She was talking away, and she was answering herself. And then she saw me there, and saw I was listening to her. And she says, that's when you have to worry, is when you start talking to yourself. I said, don't worry about it. Mary Van Bolen does it all the time. I said, in fact, she often has 3- and 4-way conversations with herself. But that's what he's doing here. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. And I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? These are the conclusions he's coming to as he's thinking about these things. Verses 1 and 2, he gives himself over to pleasure with abandonment and to sexuality. He tells himself, I will make you referring to himself, experience pleasure. I'm going to make you do this, is what he's saying here. But in his quest, he finds that laughter is mad and pleasure is of no use. He discovers that this companion, laughter is good for the soul, right? What he found is that this companion of pleasure and the pleasure itself are not fulfilling very long in and of themselves, not in this life. They do not satisfy. In his test, all kinds of pleasures, by the time he's done, have been pursued in a controlled kind of hedonism. Because he reminds us that he's doing this guided by his wisdom, by what he sees, what he thinks about and reasons about, conclusions he comes to. They range, these things, from wine as a means of sustaining and comforting himself in his search for meaning, to building great projects, to wealth, to the arts, the finest of the arts, and sex. Verses 3 to 8. Listen to this compilation of things here. I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold. Read that as taxes. Okay, silver and gold I gathered. And the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. The preacher's building projects in verses 4 to 6 are the sorts of things that ancient Near Eastern kings typically bragged about. Solomon actually did them. But what's striking here, what really is striking here, is how many of these expressions the preacher uses for his building projects, how they recall the Garden of Eden. He planted gardens, all kinds of fruit trees to water them. He made this, he made that. Wording that comes straight out of Genesis 2 and 1. It's as if the preacher is trying to create God's good and perfect world, but without God. But as the preacher indicates in Ecclesiastes 1:15, the world is now crooked and lacking, and we can't change it. There can be no creating of God's Eden. The world we now live in is fallen and cursed. God has placed a fracture in the fabric of the universe, and things are now not what they should be. And we cannot change that, not at its core. We are powerless to do that, even in ourselves. And as fallen creatures, we have built in flawed assumptions about what it means to live in this world. As I read the passage, did it strike you as to just how selfish this whole pursuit of pleasure is? Everything is I, myself, myself, myself. If you don't believe me, read through it. It's all there over and over and over again. It is me-centered. It's narcissistic. Note, too, that the accumulation of not only things and the accumulation of not only the things and of animals in verse 7, but also the accumulation of people. People as slaves and entertainers. The way he phrases it there, that the kings would use that to say, I've got the best entertainment around. They're his. And concubines. Often made, it would have been in an ancient Near Eastern context, as you made treaties with other countries and trade agreements. And so you exchanged the princesses of your court or beautiful women to seal the deal. All of this, he's doing in pursuit of rewarding life of pleasure. Now, don't we tend to use the world around us, work, possessions, and people, to leverage our own purposes to achieve our own goals? We use them as tools to master life for our own ends. But the preacher goes on to show that the world cannot be leveraged like that to suit me. In verses 9 through 11, he says, becoming great and finding pleasure in work produced no lasting gain. Verses 9 through 11. Listen to this. So I became great. I was something. I was number one. And I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Now, in Solomon's perspective, that would go back. Remember, there are kings all the way back to Melchizedek in the book of Genesis. Great kings. Kings often renowned for their wisdom. He says, I was greater than all of them. And whatever my eyes desired, and also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. These great building progress, his buttons are popping off as his chest expands. And this was my reward for all my toil. My reward for all my toil. Then, listen to this, then I considered all the toil that I had expended in doing it, all the effort he had put in as he looks over it. And behold, an epiphany happens for him. All was vanity and a striving after the wind. And there is nothing to be gained under the sun. See, the preacher had pleasure for a while in all his work until he sat back and really thought about it. It dawns on him that in reality he's gained absolutely nothing under the sun, nothing in this life. For all the hard work he's done, he'll end up empty-handed with no real profit, just sandcastles on the beach as a tide comes in. The one who gains the most toys wins. Solomon would have been a winner then with all of that. He would have been the winner. But as one commentator puts it, the preacher is showing secular man the failure of his lifestyle on its own premises, the gain, the accumulation. What's zero plus zero plus zero? Zero. We may pursue happy fulfillment in every corner of our lives, writes David Gibson, but in those same corners lurks the darkness of diminishing returns. In the end, achievements and pleasures do not last. Everything is ephemeral, a vanishing vapor. So searching out this life by wisdom and seeking gain from pleasures are chasing the wind, is trying to shepherd the wind. Next, in verses 12 to 17, the preacher discovers in a rude awakening that even the gain of wisdom over folly is chasing the wind. The use of wisdom, wise, and be wise, six times in these verses, is evenly matched by the use of folly and fool six times. But in verses 12 to 14, the first part of verse 14, they're not evenly matched in gain. Wisdom, you see, excels folly as light excels darkness. Listen to his words here. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. He went into that last week. And then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Wisdom has two advantages here. To walk in the light is to walk in spiritual uprightness in the Bible before God, while walking in darkness is to walk in spiritual disobedience. Proverbs chapter 4, verses 18 to 19 says, but the path of the righteous is like the path of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until full day. For the righteous person, for the wise person, it brightens more and more, and his uprightness becomes clearer and clearer and advances and advances. But the way of the wicked, he goes on to say, is like deep darkness. Ever been in deep darkness? You cannot see anything in front of you. No awareness of anything if you're silent. Beyond yourself there, and that's only because you're thinking, you can't even see yourself. The way of the wicked is like deep darkness. They do not know over what they stumble. The image of the wise person having eyes in his head or her head means that the wise person knows how to navigate life and all of its challenges. The fool, on the other hand, is like the blind man who stumbles as he walks. He or she has no idea how to live and so makes a mess of life. Wisdom both pleases God and empowers one to navigate life successfully. But there are limitations. Even wisdom has limitations in this life. Verse 14, the last part of it throws a monkey wrench into his thinking here. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all men. The preacher now realizes that living wisely won't stop him from being placed in a box in the ground just like the village idiot, perhaps even right next to him. And that's not all. The wise person and the fool both die and are forgotten. Verse 15 says, "Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise?" But you may think, surely there is some gain for the wise person. We may die, but our reputation can live on in the memory of those who come after us. Fools may be quickly forgotten, but isn't it likely that the wise will be remembered at least for a while, at least for a little while? Verse 16, "For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten." How the wise dies just like the fool. No wonder he ends up with all his toys, and he realizes, I haven't got anything here. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity, all is a vapor, all is a mere breath, and a striving after the wind, a shepherding of the wind. At the end of this life, even the wise person has nothing to show for having lived wisely in terms of this world. So far, the preacher has failed to find gain in life using wisdom. He's failed to find it in pursuing pleasure. He hasn't done any better in looking for it in the benefits of wisdom over folly in this life. But isn't there something actually left over when we die? I mean, generally, our possessions don't die with us, do they? We can't take them, but they're here for somebody's benefit. Most people leave some sort of inheritance behind. Now, aren't these possessions a profit, a gain from a lifetime of toil? Yeah, think again. The gain of work is transitory, left to another. First, possessions must be left to others who may be wise or they may be foolish. Verses 18 to 19. "I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he'll be master of all which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. This also is a vapor. This also is a breath that comes and goes." Like Solomon's son, Rehoboam, who succeeded Solomon to the throne and ended up losing over half his father's kingdom by his own foolish rule. He raised taxes, by the way, considerably. A lot of arguments against raising taxes, right? Or the son who ruins his father's profitable business and runs it into the ground when he inherits it because he doesn't have the same character as his father did, the same work ethic. Second, hard-earned possessions must be left for others to enjoy. Verses 20 to 23. "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun?" Any of you who have started your own business, you're an entrepreneur, you know how long it takes to get that business running and to keep it running. You work sometimes round the clock if you have to. so that you might be successful in it and it might prosper. The preacher says, this also is vanity and a great evil in this life. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. And this also is vanity. It's breath, it's a mist, it's a vapor, gone with the wind. You work hard all your life to accumulate enough to sit back and enjoy it someday, but someday never happens. And at least, at most, not for very long. Others will end up enjoying what you have lived for and sacrificed for. Jesus in Matthew 6, in verses 19 to 21, said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, under the sun, is how Ecclesiastes would put it, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And that's where God's throne is. That's above, under the sun. That's in the other realm, which is a totally different realm here in these things, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, you know the rest, there your heart will be also. Or King James, there is your heart also. Where our treasure is, that's where our heart is. That's where our hope is. That's where our joy maybe is, depending on what your treasure is. Yet when we accept the fact that before too long we're going to die, and wherever we have left the others will be gone, whenever we accept those limitations, that frees us from expecting too much from all the good things in this life that we pursue, from expecting from them what they were never meant and thus never able to give. We are free to truly enjoy this life as God's good gift. Now, the preacher is not saying there cannot be joy in life. He's going to be saying this with increasing frequency as this goes on. But the foundation of it all is all important. It's all important. We need to accept the fact that the things of this earth have their limits, severe limits when you come right down to it. And to try to put our hope in them or try to get our ultimate reason for being in them or our ultimate joy or happiness in them or lasting happiness, it cannot happen. It cannot. They are created things. There's only one who can fulfill the bill on those things. Only one. The giver, not the gift. The enjoyment of this life is God's gift. Underline that, God's gift, and underline gift. It comes freely from him. When we realize our salvation, our hope, our trust is not in things, but in the one who gives the things. Verses 24 to 26. This is where wisdom is. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. So he's laid out over and over again with his various tests the one side of the issue. Here's the other truth that has to be taken into factored in here and is actually the overriding truth by which we can live. There is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. Now, he had gotten enjoyment from his toil momentarily, but you notice in all his thing, God did not factor in those tests at all. Now, this is the God factor coming in here. This is where joy can be had. For apart from him, who can eat? And who can have enjoyment? You can't even breathe without him. You're but a breath, but you have no breath without him who gives the breath. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. What a combination there. He had wisdom and knowledge before, but no joy with what he was coming to. God's gift, God's opening up the door, the light for a person, and where the true joy resides, where the true happiness is found. He's given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he is given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. The sinner, of course, is the one who's in rebellion against God, who's crossing the boundaries, who's going his own way. Like he was kind of doing on his own search for happiness there, leaving God out. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. It's temporary. Even that in this world is temporary. Accept it as such and receive each day's gifts with joy from the hand of God and realize they may be gone tomorrow. Enjoy them while you've got them. In trying to achieve lasting satisfaction and gaining the things of this life, we miss the joy that God gives to us in the things of this life. Our focus is on them instead of on God, and we miss the real joy of things. The gift of God does not make the fleetingness or the limitations of this life go away. It's very much as much for us as for anybody else. For the wise man and the foolish, same thing there in that regard. Rather, though, it makes this vapor of life enjoyable. God does mean for it to be enjoyable, but temporary. Remember, he's got a greater joy for us. Welcome into the kingdom, good and faithful servant. You know, look at what's waiting for you here. That's permanent. This life, however, comes from God, and apart from him, we cannot truly enjoy it. This is not eat, drink, and be merry because that's all there is. No, it's eat, drink, and be merry because that's what there is. And God has given to us the good things of this world for us to enjoy, and they are their own reward as we receive them as God has given them. Don't make them more than what they really are. They are an expression, though, of the shalom, the wholeness that God intended for his creation and for humankind in particular. 1 Timothy 6 and verses 6 to 8, the Apostle Paul says that now there is a great gain in godliness with contentment. Godliness with contentment. Was he content as he was going after all these different pleasures in life and things in life? No. That was discontent. Now there is great gain in godliness with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. It's a daily joy. It's a daily thing which is renewed every day. Think of this. Every meal you eat is a renewed occasion of joy for God's provision. Every time you wake up and you're breathing, it's a renewed case to joy or for joy. Maybe raise your hands and say, praise you, Jesus, or however you do it. As I mentioned before, when I wake up, my first words are, Lord, have mercy on me. Maybe I'll get there, Bruce, someday. But anyhow, our ultimate significance and happiness are not found in the gifts, but in the giver himself. And that is the key that he brings to us here. The preacher is bringing us to this with all of what he went through. And now he comes to these couple of verses at the end. This is the punchline. This is the point that he's beginning to open up for us. Apart from him, apart from God, verse 25 points out, we cannot eat or have enjoyment. Don't miss how God is the central player here in verses 24 to 25 and in verse 26. Three times God is mentioned. He hasn't been mentioned all the way through except at the very beginning that God has given this burdensome thing or toilsome thing to do. Now, different perspective here. And it's come after he's realized everything in this world is vanishing. There's no hope in it. There's no gain in it. And it leads him to God, where the true source of everything is. God gives wisdom and joy to those who please him, while he has given the sinner the task of accumulating only to lose it. Now that can change for the sinner the moment he or she realizes that this is a momentary world, and that the giver who gives it for our joy is not momentary, but is the ultimate. It raises the certainty of divine judgment here, but also in that judgment, justice, and that means well-being and shalom and setting things right. So there's at least a hint, at least, of an ultimate reconciliation of all things, where the bent things are made, crooked things are made straight, and the things that are lacking are going to be filled. And there's justice and well-being throughout all of creation. That has to wait till not we do it, but God does it. God does it. Even so, this present world is a fallen world, and toil in it leaves much to be desired. Isaiah 65, 21 and 23 through 23 looks forward to the day of a new earth where God's people shall, quote, build houses and inhabit them, unlike what he will experience here. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. They shall not they shall not labor in vain, which is what the Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15. Know that your labor is not in vain. That's in Christ. That's the one who is ultimate. For they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord. See, our trust and our hope are not to be in the things that God gives, but in the God who gives them. I cannot say that enough. And until we have learned that, we have learned absolutely nothing. And there is no joy, not lasting joy. Now that, I think, is a subtle but clear intent of the preacher here. And with this, the Apostle Paul wholeheartedly agrees. 1 Timothy 6, going on with the passage that I read earlier, verses 17 to 18, Paul urges, as for the rich in this present age, he's going to lose it all at some point, charge them not to be haughty, not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy day by day, moment by moment. They are to do good and to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. Notice how tightly are they to hang on to their stuff. Now, the joy comes is when you hang on to it loosely and can even give it away. You're not a slave to those things. You're not a slave. Who richly provides us with everything to enjoy, there to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves, like Jesus said, as a good foundation for the future, that so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. They're not earning it here, but they're grabbing hold of what has been promised to them in Christ and faith. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground, this world, is what? Sinking sand. That's the ultimate sandcastle that's gone. It's sinking down. It doesn't exist. Christ is a solid rock. And that's precisely the direction that the preacher ultimately points us, although he doesn't have the full story of that at this point, obviously, but we do. That's the direction that he's pointing us with regard to the good things of this life. Not wisdom, he says, not pleasure, not the benefits of wisdom over folly, not possessions, but daily enjoyment and God's gift of life, daily enjoyment and God himself. The enjoyment of each day from the hand of God is meant for that day, but the giver is forever. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, help us to listen to what you are saying through the preacher here and to take it to heart. I pray, Father, that what we've heard and seen in our minds from your word today, that we cannot shake any of this loose, but it will grab onto us and not let us go until we come to acknowledge and to the realization and to the conviction that this world is passing and there's nothing in this world that can give us ultimate happiness, but only joy as we receive it from your hand moment by moment. And may we live in that moment that you give us, Father, because that's the only moment we actually have. The rest of it either has gone or maybe it's coming. But help us to listen now, Father, and to respond. Help us to trust and to rest our hopes and our affections and our love and our all in you, who have given your love to us in your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.